Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, March 30th. I'm Ray Graff. Gardening today, we welcome Greg Ward from Ward's Nursery, Fred Breglia of Landis Arboretum, Bob Graves of Fatigan's Nursery, and Dale Isler Riggs of the Berry Patch. You got a question about gardening or prepping your soil and getting it ready to go? Give us a call, 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551 or email voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org. That's the email address. The number, once again, 800-348-2551. Fred, Dale Isler, Greg, and Bob, and your questions coming up after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Gardening today, we welcome back Fred Breglia of the Landis Arboretum, Greg Ward of Ward's Nursery, Bob Graves of Fatigan's Nursery, and Dale Isler Riggs of the Berry Patch. We welcome your gardening calls right now, and we have a few already. A few open lines, so move quickly. 800-348-2551 is the number. 800-348-2551 or email voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org. Email is that, and the phone is this, 800-348-2551. All right, lots to talk about today. Weather starting to get better. Fred, Bob, Dale, Isler, Greg, welcome back to the show.
It's great to be here. Yeah, thanks for having us.
Wonderful
even
day.
Though it feels like winter out there today.
It is kind of cold today.
It was disappointing this morning at 6:30 when the car was iced up, but got to expect that, right? As long as we don't get dumped with another
foot of snow. As long as we don't get dumped. Yes.
Which could happen.
It's a spring in the Northeast, folks.
Yep, exactly.
Yes, it is.
So this email came in from Russ. For 5 years now, I've been battling brown patch with little overall success. I do not water in the evenings. I originally tried neem oil to attempt natural control with no luck. 2 to 3 years, I have alternated propiconazole of 14.3 and 0.31 azoxystrobin at two-week intervals, a limited control. You know, people, give me some phonetics here if you're writing in. It just keeps popping up and killing patches of my lawn. Other than ripping up the lawn and reseeding, all and any suggestions are welcome, and that's from Russ.
What the first thing when somebody comes into us with a lawn fungal problem is, number one, we want to find out what their irrigation is. He says he's not watering at night, which is good. But if he's watering too often, if he's watering every day, and some people are watering multiple times a day, and a lot of problems with sprinkler systems where they get turned on and we don't pay attention to when they're on and off. So certainly that's one thing to look at, is as few times a week as you can. But more importantly, when we see that, we're often looking at the pH of the soil. And very often the pH is alkaline, and if the pH is high and you have continuing fungal problems, you're just not going to be able to solve the problem until you get the pH under control. So I would be looking at that. And the other thing you would do is start overseeding with some newer varieties of grass seed to get some resistant species in there.
Anybody else?
It's also, with a lot of issues, especially fungal issues, once you see it, it's usually a little late. Control that those specific patches. So the applications, should be made prior to any symptoms.
Yep.
Anybody? Everybody satisfied? All right. That was great. This email from Brian in Forestport. What are your thoughts on the no-dig method of gardening for raised vegetable beds? Apparently, you just add compost as a top layer and don't turn over any soil. And that is from Brian in Forestport.
Yep. So, realistically, the more you know about how soils work, the more fine tillage, not plowing or folding over the soil, but fine rototilling to a dust, the more that makes no sense. Because ultimately, the plants, they need to get air into the root systems, and the air that they're basically expelling from respiration needs to get back out to the above ground air. And when you have a soil that's not fine tilled, it has all the plumbing and all the air ducts in place. So it sort of makes a lot of sense to not fine till it. And raised beds are a little different than in ground beds.
Yeah.
But at home, we for years we have not done any tilling whatsoever. We just top dress with compost and smothering areas where we want to not basically have weeds grow, and it's worked really, really well. And our last year was a really, really dry year, and we don't have a lot of extra water to give our plants. And yet, when we were pulling garlic and harvesting potatoes, it was quite moist down there because we've been building soil for a long period of time. And that just shows you that that stuff that you put on the top, like compost, it does have a vertical action. It does get down into the soil profile without any tilling necessary. You fold it over with a shovel, it's going to speed that process up a little bit, and that's okay too. So, you know, I believe strongly in not fine tilling gardens. Less is more, and you also turn up a lot less weed seeds, and you end up having a lot less work.
Greg.
Can I mention a New York Times article?
Why, of course.
So I think it was 10 days ago. Margaret Roach writes some gardening articles in the Times, and then she wrote about this gentleman in England, whose name escapes me, but a really fun, excellent article on raised beds, on very simple situations for raised beds, really not even framing. So anyone wants to jump into that and take a look, it's really, really quite interesting. Also, some there's some discussion about seeding everything first rather than, which was something that I often say, oh no, you can't, you should put your beet seeds directly into the ground. Well, he's doing starts and leaving them, you know, so you put two or three seeds in a little pack and you end up with this little clump and you go, oh my gosh, I want to pull those apart and get them all separated. No, putting them together is kind of fun too, and it was working out. It was a very interesting article.
Okay. And this was this past weekend?
It was either that one or the, I think it was the one before.
Okay.
No, the one before.
This email from Keith. I have a quick question regarding lawns. When is the best time to plant grass seed in the Albany, New York area?
Now, the best time to plant grass seed is when you've got the ability to water it, really. Grass seed needs soil temperatures of 55 degrees or so to germinate, and it needs moisture. If it gets warmth and moisture, it germinates. So spring is a great time. Fall, if you ask for the best, it's probably fall because it tends to be moister and cooler. Middle of the summer, if you can't water it, don't plant it. But you could do it in the spring now anytime, or fall is ideal, too.
Number to call here is 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. And we'll get back to the email in a little bit, but let's grab a couple of calls here before the first break. We head out to Voorheesville. Francis, you're on.
Happy spring. Can you hear me?
You bet. Go ahead.
I have a quick question, and then I'm going to hang up. I have purchased some great seeds for spring kinds of vegetables, like spinach and carrots, but I'm getting mixed messages from, not to throw them under the bus, Cornell Cooperative Extension versus, you know, gardening websites. So when is the best time to plant those spring vegetables by seed in a raised bed?
Dale Isla.
So it really depends on your soil temperatures, and it's pretty easy to just get a probe thermometer and set those the probe in your raised bed. I would not plant them until the soil temperatures are 50 to 55 degrees, but you could actually start the things like spinach and the leafy greens inside now in what we call plugs. We do that for our farm and plant 3 to 5 seeds per plug, let them get started. When the first true leaves start to show up, then we pop them in the ground, and you're going to get spinach about 3 to 4 weeks earlier than you would otherwise. Hmm. The carrots I would wait a little bit longer. They can be a little persnickety about sprouting, but right now is a great time to be starting seeds indoors. I would be waiting to plant them outdoors.
Okay, fair enough. By the way, speaking of things that grow, you brought stuff, Dale Isla. It looks delicious.
Yes.
Somewhat familiar and delicious.
We did our first harvest of baby Asian greens today, so it's a nice mix of mildly spicy greens that are nice to add to a salad, and the very first arugula as well.
Oh,
so
that's nice.
Fresh salad tonight.
We're going to pass it around. If anybody wants, Bob, you want to leave?
No? That's okay. That's okay.
Greg, what did you bring here? These look familiar as well.
It's amazing how awestruck you are by
simple
leafy,
things.
Leafy greens.
I'm a simple man, and I'm impressed with simple things. That's
true. I brought up two little cell packs. One is has larger flowers, are pansies, and the one with the smaller flowers are called violas.
Cool. We could add those to our leafy greens, couldn't we?
That's right. They're both edible.
All right. Yep. I have $2 in my wallet. You're going to eat some? Go, Bob. I want to.
$2 you could have made.
Yeah. They're quite edible.
Yeah. Are they quite edible?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Oh,
absolutely.
Have a taste. Bob, come on.
Here. I'll go if you go.
Oh, well, I didn't say I'd go. Well, you go. He's doing it. I'll give him the $2. That's it. Let's take a break. I'll get the wallet. 800-348-2551 is the number. He'll have my last $2 because I work in public radio. We'll be back and take more calls in a moment. Vox Pop, it's Gardening Today. Greg Ward from Ward's Nursery. Dale Eiler Riggs from the Berry Patch. Fred Breglia from Landis Arboretum. And Bob Graves of Fadigan's Nursery. All right, people, what's going on? How was that flower there, Bob?
That tastes like a pansy.
Really? Do you want a drink of water or something?
No, I'm fine. It's good.
I may have a flask of bourbon in the desk.
You try the bigger ones. They've got more flavor.
All right, you know what? Maybe later.
Is it similar to a nasturtium, did you say?
Not as spicy.
Not as much spice today.
Yeah, not as spicy. Okay.
New Horizons in radio fantastic. Here today. Dale Isla, what's going on over at the Berry Patch?
Berry Patch, we are seeding and planting and harvesting now, and we have a blueberry pruning workshop that we have planned for folks. It's going to be on Saturday, April 15th from 10 a.m. to noon. Need to bring your own hand pruners. It'll be hands-on pruning. I'll be coaching people how to do it, and you can check out our website, theberrypatch.net, to find out more.
Now, is there a trick? I know that Fred has gone on about the proper way to prune trees, and I almost understand now after all these years. What's the trick with the blueberries?
So with the blueberries, you want to maintain a nice open canopy, and you want to get rid of the old, unproductive wood. You want to get rid of really big, thick stems that aren't very productive anymore, anything that is broken, crossing over. You're trying to maximize fruiting area and the amount of light that the flowers get.
And that's this Saturday? Or
no, it's Saturday, April 15th.
Okay. Of course, you'll be back here before then, so we can mention it again as
That's
well.
That's true.
Greg, what's going on over at Ward's Nursery?
Yeah, well, you know, spring is happening, even though it snowed a little bit this morning, and it's a little chilly. So we're taking in lots of trees and shrubs, fruit trees, some pansies. We're thinking about perennials. Herbaceous perennials should show up very soon. And it's just, that's what happens every year, and it's pretty exciting.
Exciting time, busy time for you, though, right?
Very busy, yes.
Fred, I assume that you have lots going on over at the Landis.
Yeah, we always, we're pretty busy. We stay busy over there. But we're kicking off, we already kicked off just recently, our 23 big tree search.
Ooh.
So we're looking for big trees. Anything that qualifies for the New York State Big Tree Register are species that we're giving prizes for, so we're looking for them. We already have quite a few nominations came in already, and a few of those, including one for a pawpaw, looks like it might be a new state champion. Now, just to give you an idea that, you know, when you're looking for champion trees, first off, not everything is going to look big to the average person. So an oak tree that gets really big, it's going to stand out. It's going to be a huge tree. A pawpaw that gets big might have a diameter of a stem under 2 feet in diameter, and that's just really, really big for a pawpaw. Apparently, it's happy. It's probably living next to a mama.
Hey,
So keep your eye out and visit our website, landisarboretum.org. Everything's posted and all the submittal process. We're also gearing up for Landis-grown stuff in our greenhouse, kind of like what Greg said. We're getting ready to start early next week, flower baskets that'll be raised for the spring plant sale that's coming up the weekend after Mother's Day this year.
You know, so. It's funny. I almost put up for the webpage for today's show that picture of you hugging the giant tree.
Well, we'll send you some more.
No, but I put the picture up of you with a giant mushroom, which is disturbing on a number of levels. If you want to go to WAMC.org, you can see that one.
Yep.
Bob Graves, what's happening over at Fadigan's?
Well, we've got some seminars coming up. If you go to check our website, we'll do some things on lawns and pruning and that sort of thing. And as with Greg, we've got plants coming in from all over the country. We got loads today from Oregon and Ohio and Connecticut and New Jersey and lots of stuff coming in.
So this is a nice day for you to say, hey, listen, fellas,
you got this. See ya.
He's busy.
Right. Let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551 is the number. Bess is in Alford, Mass. Bess, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I've got two questions, one about hydrangeas and one about hellebores.
Okay. Go ahead.
So, for the hydrangeas, I know they're a very common plant, but I've never had them before. And I left the flowers on all winter because I thought they looked nice out there, dried, like little dried flowers for some texture in the winter. When is a good time to cut them down, or have I done something wrong?
Sounds like the hydrangeas you're thinking about are the panicle ones with the big cone-shaped flowers.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true? Yeah. You have plenty of time. Pruning any time in the next several weeks. Usually with that plant, you're trying, the stems will be, very long with the flowers on top. And so that stem should probably be cut in half or possibly even a little more than half. So reduced by, a third or so is always a nice idea. And then thinned of any smaller branches, anything that's very tiny and didn't really produce a flower, you can actually remove those. So you're really opening it up into this, I like to call it a fork, even though, it's sort of rounded. Very clean, cutback stems. And then anything that's, competing or cracked or damaged maybe from the snow could be removed as well. And again, in the next, any time between now and when they start to grow, which will be, sometime in early May.
Anybody?
Oh, okay, great. Good, I've got some time. Yep. Then the hellebores, I planted them near my house because they like some shade, I think. And then all the snow has fallen off my roof onto them. So I think now is the time when they should start growing, but they're under piles of snow.
Mm. So they will just wait until the snow is gone, and you'll have some possibly slightly later hellebores.
Yeah, they should all be straightened out, though, once the snow melts and they start to grow. So
they're pretty tough.
They are pretty tough. I mean, the ones at the Arboretum are looking pretty bad under the snow as well. So we're with you, but it really just comes down to that they end up having a little later season, and that's not always a bad thing.
All right, Bess, thanks for the call. Number is 800-348-2551. It's Gardening Today with Delilah Riggs, Bob Graves, Greg Ward, and Fred Breglia. And we go to Jim in Schenectady. Jim, you're on.
Thanks for taking my call. I just had a quick question. I've got a balsam fir tree in front of my house that I planted to decorate, and I've been keeping up with trimming it every year. My question to you is, I've been getting some aphids, and I'm being told that in April is when the aphids kind of go to the end of the extreme branches and start sucking all the juices out of the pine needles, and then they start curling up on you. Number one, what's the best thing to put on top of that to kill the aphids before they damage the tree? And number two, when is the best time to apply it?
Yeah, so first I'll say that the balsam twig aphid is probably one of the, probably most prominent pests associated with balsam fir. It's also can be found on Fraser fir. And in general, with the landscape, I don't usually recommend doing too much with it because it's not going to really hurt your tree. It's not going to kill your tree. It's just going to cause some disfigured foliage. If you're in the Christmas tree business or wreath business and you're using that foliage, then, that's more of a reason to control it, I guess, than I would, So in a landscape, not too big of a deal unless you're really noticing that it's covering your whole tree, in which case I do believe it's a spring application.
The aphids are pretty easy to get rid of with a contact insecticide, like an insecticidal soap.
Yep, or an maybe oil. A light oil,
or
some sort.
Something like that. Hard to control. You can use a systemic, but it's easy to get it once they're there with a contact type. But with contacts like soap, if you don't hit it, you don't kill it.
Yeah, but the good news is that, if you left it untreated, I've never really seen, one of these trees die from that pest, luckily.
The other thing I would watch for on balsams around here is spider mite. I've had a problem with spider
mite. And that could be worse.
Balsam. Yeah,
in fact.
Because balsams really like it a little cooler climate than what we have.
Yep. Yeah, we're a little hotter than they like it. That's for sure. Unless they're planted in a microclimate.
What does a spider mite look like? Would I actually see that bug on the needle?
You have to look real close. It'd be on the underside of the needle, and it'll discolor the needles.
Yeah.
It looks stippled, like it sucked the juice out of it.
Yeah, it has almost like it has a funny tint to the foliage as well. But if you're describing that sort of deformed growth, that sounds like the aphid. Because the aphid's going to suck, like the like the spider mite, but the spider mites tend to, I think, create a general decline, a thinning and a stippling of the foliage, whereas the aphids actually will create a disfigured, much more noticeable disfigured foliage.
Might be worth a horticultural oil as a preventative spray, and you're coming up to a good time for that.
Timing-wise, is getting right into it.
Yep. So the aphids... we'd have to double check on the timing, but it is probably spring. So as soon as it warms up and we have 24, 48 hours of above freezing temperatures with no rain. For the spider mites, if that's also an issue, it's usually not something that they're usually not active until summer, you know, June, July. So a follow-up application at that point is probably the thing to do. But if you want some help finding the timing on the aphids and you wanted to just email info@wardsnursery.com, I can help you with that.
And if you're worried about the mites, they do show up when it's hotter conditions. You will need a hand lens to look at the bottom of the needles, but there's actually beneficial predator mites that you can release that will do a good job on controlling the pest mites. We use those on our raspberries all the time.
Oh, cool.
Yep, and if you have a section of the plant that looks like it is attacked by a spider mite, you could use a piece of paper underneath it and just kind of tap the foliage. And a lot of times, if they are loaded with spider mites, they'll fall out on a paper. And these are really, really small. They're smaller than the aphids. I mean, you are going to need a hand lens to see them. But if they fall on a piece of paper, they'll start moving around, and they're a lot easier to see. It's just a good way to scout for pests.
Jim, thanks for the call. It's Gardening Today, 800-348-2551. Email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Dorothea wrote in from Clifton Park. We have a mature mulberry bush or tree in our yard that seems to be in good shape and healthy, yet we never have any berries on it. We don't know the exact age, but it's about 5 yards tall. When, if ever, can we expect to see some berries?
I have read that you can have some male and female on different plants with mulberry. Not always, but sometimes. So it's a possibility that either there's not a pollinator around or it's a male. Most of them have the same male and female flowers on the same plant, but that's a possibility.
And there's also a chance, I mean, the birds are beating you to it. I mean, I've certainly seen cases where people have told me that, you know, they're amelanchiers don't produce berries, but you could see where the berries used to be when I've looked at those plants, and that's because the birds are just quicker and faster at getting them. Maybe it's not getting a heavy fruit set.
It might be a little shaded, so it's not flowering as well. Definitely,
I was thinking
want
that
to know
too.
If it's is it flowering would be the first thing.
That's the first question.
Yeah. Yeah. If you don't get the flowers, you're not going to get the fruit.
You don't get flowers, you don't get fruit.
You know, that could be part of it. If it is shady, I know they don't tend to do as well. They like more sun. They'll grow in the shade, no problem. But they won't produce. It's like lilacs. They just don't produce a lot of flowers.
They kind of be a weedy, invasive thing sometimes.
They can be.
The birds spread those seeds, and they're everywhere.
And they're prolific,
Number to call here is 800-348-2551. We'll go to North Adams and Steven. Steven, you're on.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got probably about 3 acres of land that I used as a header, and it was all logged off the property, and now everything's out of there, and I want to fix that property. That land, I want to seed it. There's nothing there, no stumps, no logs, no nothing. I'm just going to back drag it and smooth it all out. There's no big rocks or nothing, and it's pretty good. But I mean, it looks like good, rich topsoil, but it's soil that's out in the woods. You know, it hasn't been worked or nothing. Should I just start off with some lime, or what should I do?
Well, you got to get a soil test first, because you don't know whether you need lime or not. Get a soil test, see what your pH is. You know, the fact that it was a forest doesn't mean it's bad soil. That might be really good stuff.
That was the first thing I was thinking. You're probably looking at some pretty good soil there.
I'd loosen it up a little bit, seed it, and go.
Yep, and you could use a combination of things, anything from lawns, or you could go like a wildflower mix even, because it's all there.
Wildflower mix, pasture mix.
Pasture mixes, so you get a little bit more flowers in there. When you do the wildflower mixes, generally you don't get, they'll give you a whole bunch of different kinds of flowers, and then that usually turns into three or four different types.
Usually ends up being all rutabaga.
You're right, exactly, because a lot of them just won't come back. But that first year will be very prolific, and then after that, you'll still get a lot of flowers. The ones that are going to make it are going to do good. It might be a better choice than just putting turf grass.
All right.
Turf grass?
A wildflower mix.
Something to hold it, so it doesn't wash away. I'll spend some time, grading it all off and making it look nice, and
get some,
feed it all in, so it'll come back and keep the property so it doesn't wash away.
Whatever you do, get some perennial rye in there, because that's going to germinate the fastest and give you the best erosion control quickly.
All right, Stephen, we appreciate the call. 800-348-2551 is the number. Sheila in Albany. Sheila, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm calling about pruning of a yucca plant. Hmm. I have one in the front. It gets basically morning sun. It's probably 5.5 feet in diameter. It's extremely healthy. It's a beautiful green right now, very little brown underneath it. However, the flowers probably get to almost 6.5 feet in height, and it's just getting out of control. When's the best time I can prune that?
So when you say pruning, you really are dividing. You're actually, it's sold sort of as a woody plant, but I would say it's really more of an herbaceous, evergreen perennial. So it's sending up secondary, pups basically around the original plant. So it's not usually just one plant, right? You have multiple stems now flowering, multiple heads. Is that true?
Right.
Yeah. So you need a spade, a nice long sharp spade, and you're going to dig in and take pieces away.
She can cut off the old flower stalks, right?
Definitely take down the old flower stalks. Yeah. I'm sorry, and any lower brown leaves can come off immediately. Certainly, if that's all you want to do. But if you're trying to reduce the width of it, make it just smaller, you will need to divide it.
Right, because they don't really lend itself to being reduced like a woody plant would be. In other words, there's no real reduction point. It's divide it, but not really reduce it in terms of the crown.
Right, and are those roots really deep? Because I know the stalks itself, those are sharp and really strong.
The roots don't seem too bad to me. I've moved them around. We have some at the Arboretum that have been there for a really long time, and we've moved them around, and they seem pretty good for moving. They're not overly tough. They're real fibrous. It's more of a fibrous root system, but it's not a real deep, woody root system. So to me, that makes it a lot easier to move. And anytime I think of fibrous root systems, I always think they're more forgiving. They're easier to transplant.
Okay.
All right, Sheila, thank you very much. 800-348-2551. It's the Gardening Show with Bob Graves from Fatigan's Nursery, Dale Isla Riggs from the Berry Patch, Greg Ward from Ward's Nursery, and Fred Breglia from Landis Arboretum. And we'll go to our friend Joan in Schenectady. Joan, you're on.
Thank you, Ray, and greetings to all of our experts. Hey, Ray, when I was on the line with Anissa Wahid on one of our Food Fridays, we started talking about fenugreek, and a good chef did not know how to cultivate it. So you teased me about the gardening show, here I am.
I don't think I teased you. I said this is the time to call and ask about it. And I must confess, I have zero recollection of the conversation, but I'll take you at your word.
I don't expect you to remember every show you do.
Okay, but anyway.
Hey, guys.
Go ahead.
How do we grow fenugreek, and what kind of a plant is it?
That's a great question, because we're all shaking our heads. What kind of a plant is it?
I have memories from many, many years ago of growing fenugreek sprouts to add to salads and such. So it ought to be a herbaceous, probably small plant. And I would just suggest that you get some fenugreek seeds and try seeding a little flat of them and see what comes up. But I've only ever raised them as sprouts, and that was many, many years ago.
Okay. Excellent. And what's the taste like?
My recollection was it tasted green.
Ah.
there's nothing that made me say, and again, this was many years ago, but there was nothing that made me say, oh, wow, I got to do these again.
If you're not still growing them, it must not have made too big an impression.
Right. I think, you know, there was a little bit of, I won't say quite spiciness, but a little bit of tang to them. But okay. Nothing that stuck with me that made me want to do it the rest of my life.
Yeah, and you know, we learn something all the time. So that's a new one for me as well. Just curious with that Food Friday, what were they mixing it with? How were they incorporating it?
You got me swinging.
I was asking about how to blend your own curry spices.
Oh,
now I remember.
So something that they used in that.
Have you tried Wikipedia?
It's a warm spice. Yeah, I don't do a computer.
Oh, that's right,
Joan. I'm your techno Luddite.
That's exactly right. So it's kind of like the Flintstones. This is new for you using the phone. I like that you call in, Joan. We have to take a break, and we will find out more about fenugreek at a later date. 800-348-2551. Oh, some game show music. All right, Bachelorette number two, what do you got going on? Zach, the engineer, is like, all right, enough. I'm going to turn the mics on. All right, good for you. I didn't cue it exactly, but I think you're absolutely right. It's gardening today, 800-348-2551. And, okay, so anybody else want to say anything before we go to the email bag? Anything fenugreek related? Oh, hearing nothing. It's the first time that ever happened on this show. John from Dalton writes, I have a 14-foot-high, 6-to-8-inch diameter flowering crabapple tree, very healthy, about 4 foot off the ground. The tree has 3 main trunks. As a result of the mid-March snowstorm, the middle trunk split about 3 feet above the junction of the 3 main trunks. I removed what broke and split. Will this tree survive? Is there anything I can do to help?
Yeah,
that's from John.
So first off, the tree most likely would survive. So it's just a matter of now pruning it in such a way to restore the crown. And, you know, if you wanted to, I guess if you wanted to send me a photo of that, I might be able to steer it. You in a little bit better of a direction in terms of what you would do.
Okay.
And Fred at landisarboretum.org. And generally, though, we should be able to restore it. I mean, I've seen some incredibly busted up plants, and you know, this is a big year for it, too. I've got a lot of damage at the arboretum. A number of the snowstorms got us more than I would have thought this year. But so we're doing a lot of restoration on a lot of plants. And if you have a little patience and you give it a few years, usually you can restore it. And if you know what you're doing, you can even almost sometimes improve that plant structure. So shoot me an email with that photo or two of that plant, that crabapple, and we'll make sure you're making the right cuts.
And once again, that email address, Fred?
It's Fred at landisarboretum.org.
And Landis is L-A-N-D-I-S, right?
Correct. A-R-B-O-R-E-T-U-M.
All right.
All one word.
This is from our pal Pamela in Troy. Greetings, gurus. That's how she begins the email. From May 2022 to February 23, I was having work done on my home, and part of my lawn was under stacks of lumber and stuff needed to do the work. As a result, I have an area of dead lawn about 8 feet wide by 30 feet long, just bare dirt. Next up is exterior painting, so I figure there's no point in trying to begin a new lawn until the next round of trampling is done, hopefully by the end of May, However, I also expect to host many people in the yard in early to mid-June. I'm wondering if there is something hardy and fast-growing I can use to cover the dirt slash mud until I start a new lawn, something that could help the battered soil as well. Also, is mid-June too late to begin a new lawn? What would be the best time to give it a good start? That's from Pamela in Troy. I would, I'd go ahead and seed it now or any time in the next few weeks. Get something going. It may survive better than you think. Yeah, but what about the everybody traipsing around the painters and everything? You know, put lumber on there, that's one thing, but just walking around on it's not necessarily a disaster.
If the painters aren't coming till the 1st of May.
Yeah, you've got time to get something up and growing if you use some perennial rye in with it.
And then painters, they're not supposed to walk all over the lawn.
Really?
They're supposed to be on the ladders. Close to the house.
Now,
what about break time?
If she does,
that's true.
If she does do it in June, the trick is you can grow grass, but you're going to have to water it.
Right, just keeping it wet is the challenge.
And sometimes, if it's really hot like last year, it's three times a day.
It is, and all it really takes is when it's starting to sprout for that to dry out.
It dries out once when it's got that little green fuzz, it's dead.
Right, exactly. Once it gets that green fuzz, before it sprouts, you're okay. But once that sprout, you're going to lose it.
So I'd get it going.
I think I'd agree with you. You just kind of get it going. You're going to lose some of it when they walk around, but you're going to have more. A lot of that root will end up staying around, and you're going to be better off probably. Worst case, you just do a little bit of overseeding, reseeding, but you'll have. It's better than starting the an empty plate.
Now, could she plant fenugreek?
She could, because I checked it. Sprouts pretty quickly.
Yeah,
it's quick and easy, apparently.
All right,
but the painters are going to eat it.
I was going to mention though,
is adorable when we walk on it. Is the biggest question.
Seriously though, I was going to mention.
Okay.
A thing called sod.
So
there are farms that grow grass, cut it into lengths, and then you relay it on your lawn. And that would, especially for the party.
Yeah, she could
wait till
overnight. You could get it
till mid May. Put it down, and within 3 weeks, it's ready to walk on.
Oh, beautiful. Okay, this is from James in Smallwood, New York. When I bought my home a few years ago, I discovered the previous owner had knowingly planted a rather large 15-foot lilac bush atop my septic drain field, which lies underneath the flower bed. Last week, I had an arborist remove the lilac. What could I plant above the drain field to replace the lilac that is, one, pretty, and two, won't send deep damaging roots down into the drain field? That's from James.
Yeah, so I guess we would probably agree here. Herbaceous is probably your best bet. So, you got a lot of options. But I don't think you want to do woody plants.
Any trees or shrubs are going to seek out that water.
They are. So, the woody roots are problematic because they're not going away on an annual basis. They're staying and they get larger with time. So opening up the door for herbaceous material, the roots are not going to go as deep. They're not going to be as catastrophic. I think you have all sorts of different things you can do that are native that work really well. You could make a perennial garden. You could just seed it. There's a lot of options.
Make it a wildflower garden.
Yes. Yep.
Absolutely.
Yep, for sure. Yep.
You don't want to grow plants, right? You don't want to grow vegetables and such over the septic field. Personally, or do you?
No. Well, I wouldn't. Again, just if you're eating that stuff, then that's a separate area.
Okay.
But in terms of veggies growing there, yes, they would work. In terms of the veggies doing damage to the septic system, no, they won't really damage your septic system.
Substantial raised beds. So that you're actually, basically you're putting containers on the ground.
Yeah, you could do that as well.
Which means that your plants, your edible plants, are living in just the soil in the container.
Gotcha.
They're not affected by
the
leach field.
Yep, just avoid woodies.
Okie doke. This is from, let's go back to the phones. We'll go to Lynn in Silver Falls. Lynn, you're on.
Hello.
Oh, hello.
Is that me? Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You bet.
Yes. I do have a question about grass as well. And I cleared out my backyard. It's still all trees, but it was a lot of leaves. I'm down to the ground. What kind of grass or what do you recommend? And it's very shady.
If it's real shady, you're not going to grow grass. You're just not going to. If you can trim the trees out some or limb them up a little bit. I mean, there are grasses that'll do better in shade, the fine fescues and the like, but grass needs, 3 or 4 hours of some sun to grow at all.
Can you buy moss spores?
I would go online. I suspect you probably could. And moss is not a bad option in that situation.
No, it's tricky to get established.
Right.
So if you see moss out there quite regularly, then you kind of have a condition. Moss likes a condition. So if you have it, it's easy to get it. And if you don't have that, it may not be too suitable. Vinca is another plant that would probably work pretty well.
Vinca, Pachysandra.
Pachysandra would also be it. Vinca, I've seen
that
growing.
You don't really walk on them, but it'll grow.
Yep.
We have Pachysandra and Vinca, and it is lovely. I have one additional question, please.
Sure.
It's about morning glories. And I understand that I don't know how much dirt they need, but I'd like to start them inside, and I need a suggestion of how deep I should plant them in a planter that I'm going to put out. I'm going to leave them in the dirt.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, we've grown morning glory from seed before. We just start them in our standard seed starting plugs and then
hold on, hold on. I'm having a hard time hearing you.
Oh, boy. Don't yell, Dale Isla, but maybe just come a little closer to the mic.
Okay.
Yeah, I really can hardly hear you, Greg.
Right. Okay, fine. Right. Well, maybe you ought to listen on the podcast.
That's better.
Oh, okay. All right, Dale Isla, what do you got?
Okay, so we grow morning glories. We just start them in our standard seed starting plugs, and then once they're up and have true leaves, we plant them out in the garden where we want them to be. They're easy to grow. There's not really any special thing that you need to do.
No, they're prolific. So, you know, they're definitely one of the easy ones to grow.
They'll grow in a small, you know, a shallow container. Yep. You'll just have to water frequently. So a standard window box could work. I mean, I probably would like to see more soil than that. But if that's what you have, maybe a 12-inch pot, you know, usually if it's 12 wide, it's 12 high, and you could put several seeds in there. My one thing would be don't start them too early. They're very fast.
Yep, they are fast.
Yeah, I would. Okay. We would usually seed them around the 1st of May. We would plant the seeds around the 1st of May.
Yep.
Okay, Lynn, thanks for the call. We'll go now to Chicopee. And Chris, you're on.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hi. My mulberry tree last year had so many berries that it was touching the ground.
Wow.
But my question is about Cana. When should I replant my Cana?
A little early.
Yeah, so you can take them up and put them in a container and keep them inside and get them started.
Yeah, they've been inside all winter.
But dormant in the basement.
Yes.
Yeah, so you could, if you want to get them going sooner, any time in the next, you know, even today, but any time in the next week, so you could bring them and keep them inside in a sunny place, water them, and they will start to grow, but you don't want to transplant them or move them outside until we're pretty much frost-free, so at least mid-May, say.
Okay, mid-May. All right. Yeah, these are stunning. I got them late in the year. They're yellow and green striped leaves,
nice.
But they didn't bloom yet because I got them late, so I just want to maximize the ability. Is there anything that I need to add to the soil to make them happy?
I would definitely, if you're going to keep them in the container or transplant them at some point, I would certainly consider adding some fertilizer, some nutrients, either something that's going to stay in the container that's slow release, or when you transplant them into the ground, something you work into the soil.
Yeah, it's a large pot that they're going to go into in the back, so something slow release. So that sounds wonderful.
All right. Well, Chris, thanks for the call. We are joined today on this edition of Gardening by Greg Ward of Ward's Nursery. You just heard him speak. Dale Isla Riggs from the Berry Patch, Fred Breglia of Landis Arboretum, and Bob Graves from Fatigan's Nursery. And we go to High Falls. Bill, you're on.
Yeah, hi. Good afternoon, everybody.
Hello.
I have some lilac bushes that are currently occupying a spot that we'd like to use for a vegetable garden. I also have a place that would be appropriate for them. Is this a terrible time of year to move lilac bushes?
No.
Good time, right?
Good time, yep.
Excellent
time. Yep, as soon as that soil becomes workable, you could move them. So, you know, depending on where you are, we still have snow in our yard, but depending on where you are, it'll be coming up really soon. And the great news is lilacs are easy to transplant. They work really well. They have great root systems. They're tolerant of abuse when you move them. So if you end up losing some soil or it falls off, just get them. If you move them before they're actively growing, they're going to wake up and just take right off.
All right. Going to do it next week.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Let us know how you did. This is from Bob in West Hurley. Is there any way to rid our raised bed garden of voles and moles? We have installed hardware, cloth under some of the beds, but our grub pesticides and castor oil granules the best antidote? And that's from Bob in West Hurley.
I like Dale Isla's solution for that.
Me too.
What's that?
Yeah,
we
do snap traps, but we put in a PVC pipe around the perimeter of the planting, and the voles always like running in those pipes, and you have a snap trap in there. They can't get around them, and they're gone.
Yeah, we bait them with peanut butter.
What size snap traps? Pipe?
We do about two and a half inch yep. pipe.
Sounds right. Yeah. Enough for that snap to come
you
over.
Just gotta, exactly. It's got to trap in there to work.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. And remember that voles are not the same as moles. So the moles are going after grubs, and these snap traps aren't going to get rid of moles. They're going to get rid of voles, which are the ones that eat the plants, and they girdle a lot of our woody plants, and they eat a lot of roots of plants. So generally, they're the ones that are the most problematic. You know, moles tend to be more of a, I guess, a lawn nuisance for some folks. Personally, we don't mind them. They're eating grubs, so we don't really typically do anything to control moles. But yeah, I'm assuming that most of his problem is probably moles.
The voles are omnivorous. They will eat anything, moles, mostly plants.
That's
but
right.
The moles are primarily for earthworms. And
yeah, and I'm thinking most of their problems are probably vole-related, not moles.
No,
exactly.
Voles.
Yep.
But these are raised beds. Is that normal?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they'll go anywhere. Yeah. In greenhouses,
hoop
houses.
They'll hop up on the bench and eat plants in a pot.
They sure will.
Do you have your method on your website? You're an evil genius, I have to be honest.
Maybe I should add it.
Maybe.
I think you should. That's YouTube gold right there. Let's go to Henry in Hyde Park. Henry.
Yeah, hey, folks. Sorry to do this, but I had to go back to a septic system-related question. I have a cherry tree that's awfully close to the septic field. I think it's an ornamental tree. It's never had any fruit on it or anything, but it's about 15 feet high. I'm wondering how deep the roots and go on that kind of a tree, and also if I cut it like way back, could I kind of stop the roots from expanding out too much?
Yeah. So the physiology of a plant like that is safe to say that the roots are not going really deep except for right underneath the plant, which are the anchoring roots. So immediately underneath that trunk, you've got roots that are going down, and they're holding that plant into the soil from tipping over in winds and snow loads. And then the feeder roots of that plant are going to go down 12, 15 inches under the soil surface, and they'll stretch out, if they have enough room, three times the canopy spread. So they can go as far as three times the canopy spread if it's been there a while, but not much deeper than 15 inches. So it's quite shallow when you start getting out to three times the canopy spread, very shallow root systems. And, you know, pruning it back hard, I don't think is going to get rid of a root system. The root system's there, you know, so you would just probably want, the plant will just want to put on corresponding growth. But so if that helps you as a general guideline, that might tell you whether or not that's in a problem zone or not.
All right, Henry, appreciate the call. We'll go to Syracuse. Cindy, you're on. Hello, Cindy. Goodbye, Cindy. That was a half-hour wait for that one. We'll hang up. This email from Bruce in Plainfield, Massachusetts. I keep trying to start lupin seedlings indoors under grow lights, and they keep dying when they are about 3/4 of an inch tall. Other flower and vegetable seedlings I'm starting indoors generally do just fine. Do lupins need something special? And that's from Brooke in Plainfield, Massachusetts.
Interesting. I don't think that there should be an issue if everything else is not getting some kind of, you know, fungal, you know, stress of some kind. I would consider it just to solve that problem, starting them outdoors.
Yeah. And then one thing to consider is that if they are the species of lupin that are in the pine bush, those are actually a little bit tricky to just straight out propagate. There's a mycorrhizal relationship with the lupins in the pine bush. And I know that because a professor at SUNY Cobleskill, when I was there many moons ago, studying for college, who cracked the code on how to germinate them correctly. And it had a mycorrhizae association. But to my knowledge, that was only the ones that the Conroy blue butterfly likes in the pine bush. That's not general lupins. The ones at the Arboretum are not those species. And boy, oh boy, the seeds just fall on the ground and they come back prolifically.
Right. So starting them in a little nursery bed outside, and you could be seed, if you have the seed, you could actually be doing that this month coming.
It might just solve the problem.
Yeah, you could start them outside. We've very successfully grown them indoors as well. I just wonder if maybe being a little too heavy on the watering, that maybe you're getting some root-borne diseases because of overwatering.
All right, I guess we'll have to wrap it up there. Fred, how do people find the Landis Arboretum online?
It's landisarboretum.org.
Dale Isla, The Berry Patch.
TheBerryPatch.net.
Greg Ward, Ward's Nursery.
Ward'sNursery.com.
And Bob Graves, Fadigans.
Fadigans.com.
Well, listen, folks, we are now on our two-week schedule for the warm weather months. We'll see you in 2 weeks. Thanks for all being here.
And Ray's going to take his salad and his pansies home for
By the way, how did the flower settle with you? Did you get sick? You need some Pepto? I got some Alka-Seltzer in the desk.
I'm still talking to you.
They say it takes 24 hours for most of these things to kick in. So to be seen.
Well, we'll find out in 2 weeks. Support comes from Saratoga Jewish Community Arts, presenting a Zoom discussion of The Zookeeper's Wife, April 16th at 7 p.m. sjca.sjcf@gmail.com for required registration. Thanks again to the gang for being here. They will be back in 2 weeks' time and answer all those people, hopefully the lady in Syracuse who was on the line for half an hour and then was gone. You know, call in 2 weeks early and we'll try to get you on the show. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer, Susie Check, I screened the calls. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow it's Food Friday and the show I never thought would happen is coming. We're going to talk sushi with Michael Marcus of Bizen in Great Barrington. Should be a thrill ride. We'll see you at 2:00.